turned on my headlamp, and sat up, reaching for the shelter's logbook. 2 pages before the final entry was another full-page cartoon, Bear Hunt Episode 2. In the first frame, which filled the top half of the page, our spiky blonde hero was still walking with his stake on a hook, muttering, "Geez, no bears yet." 2 other hikers looked on from a distance, wondering, "What the fuck is he carrying?" The bottom half of the page was a bloodbath. A bear with funny ears and a big round butt filled the frame. Beside one cute fuzzy paw was a human foot severed at the ankle, still wearing a boot. Blood splattered on the shredded torsos of the 2 hikers who had only moments ago been mocking our hero. One of them reached desperately for help, his face a twisted mask of horror as the bear gnawed on his dead friend's skull. The caption read, "To be continued in next shelter, Lemmy." "He's only a few days ahead of me," I thought. I really hoped I could catch this guy. I wondered what was up with his spelling. The spiky blonde hero had a sort of anime look about him. Maybe Lemmy was Japanese. I flipped to the last entry, which stopped near the middle of the page. Thinking back to the little orange salamanders I'd watched while stopping by a big rock for a snack earlier, I clicked my pen and wrote, "If I stopped to give each breathtaking view the full attention it deserves, I'd never get anywhere." Then I signed it, Green Giant. So how do you, go to the bathroom in the woods? This question gets asked a lot. Every time I hear it, I'm amazed that it even needs to be asked. Sometimes I like to pause before I answer, to let the asker think for a second. Let's imagine that you're in the woods alone and the urge hits. What would you do? Whatever answer you come up with is probably right. I dig a hole, I poop in the hole, I cover the hole. This is, of course, an oversimplification, but there are several preferred methods for digging your poop hole, and you'll get a lot of different answers from every hiker you ask. I carry a small but sturdy orange plastic trowel that weighs less than an ounce. As an added bonus, its length is precisely the prescribed depth, 6 inches. Other hikers will tell you that a boot heel or the end of a trekking pole will do just fine, but whatever you use, make sure you dig deep. Believe it or not, there are forest creatures who are attracted to the smell of your dung, and we don't want to encourage them. Perhaps now is too late to mention this, if you've already dug your hole, but location is important, too. I assume that you're smart enough not to dig a poop hole 10 feet away from your tent. I like to give humanity the benefit of the doubt. As we'll see later, this is not always justified. But for now, we go for a stroll. Trowel in one hand, poop kit in the other. I like to use a small waterproof stuff sack for my toiletries. Toothpaste, toothbrush, some wipes, Advil, that sort of thing. I carry these items about 100 or 200 feet away from camp, and especially away from water, for what should be obvious reasons. When the hole is dug, I place my feet on either side, pull my pants down to my knees, squat, and wait. "But Green Giant," people say, "isn't it harder to go when you're squatting?" To them I say, "No, it's easier than sitting. When you squat, your poop chute straightens, making it faster and easier to get the job done." Long enough, though, that I was still in the full squat position when I heard Katie's car. Back home, 12 cars an hour could drive by our house unnoticed, but my ears would perk up at her specific road noise from 1/2 mile away. Hers was the only car that morning, and I heard the engine stop and the door open and shut. Katie was early, as usual. "I'm pooping," I yelled, hoping my engine sound identification skills had not misled me this time. "Okay, I'll be right here." Good, it was Katie. I pulled up my pants and walked up a small wooded incline toward the standing Indian trailhead parking lot. First I saw Katie's car, and then I saw her. I ran to her and wrapped my arms around her. We kissed passionately. "You don't smell as bad as I thought you would," she said, "and I can feel your ribs." "I can't have lost that much weight," I said. "It's only been a week. Come hang out with me while I pack up." My camp didn't take long to break down, because I wasn't carrying much. My small tent was only 2 pounds, and there wasn't much to it, just a mesh cocoon with a rain cover. That, plus an inflatable air mattress for comfort and insulation from the ground chill, and a sleeping bag which, according to the manufacturer, would prevent hypothermia in temperatures as low as 20 degrees Fahrenheit. My wardrobe consisted of what I was wearing, plus a spare shirt, spare pants, socks, and underwear. These all went into waterproof stuff sacks, as did my sleep system. I started using waterproof stuff sacks for everything a few years ago, after a stream crossing gone wrong soaked my pack. Last to go was my Kindle and some cookware, a single titanium pot with a jetboil burner. "What's for breakfast?" Katie asked as I tightened the last of my pack straps. "I'm still trying to figure that out," I said. I'd started my trips with dehydrated dinners and breakfasts that were delicious, packed full of calories and quick to prepare. But at $7 apiece, twice a day for 5 or 6 months, they seemed too pricey. There had to be a cheaper alternative, but I hadn't found it yet. "I just had a Clif Bar and some coffee this morning because I knew you were bringing food. You did bring food, right?" She assured me that she had, and soon we were at her car going through the loot. It was more than enough for the next few days. "I made a pizza last night, and oh boy, are you ready for this? I found a recipe online for blueberry scones. I brought extra so we could feed other hikers." I had told her about big ups and floats. "That's so cool that you're already meeting other thru-hikers," she said. "They sound fun." "Yeah, well, don't get too attached. They're ready to start doing 20-mile days, and I'm not." "Aw," she frowned. "It's okay," I said. "I've been checking the shelter logs. There are tons of people up ahead. Behind, too, I'm sure. Last night was actually the first I've camped alone so far. It was nice." We put the pizza and scones into her day pack and started north, arriving shortly at the shelter. Big ups and floats were still packing when we arrived. Their eyes grew huge when Katie revealed the scones. "No way! We couldn't possibly," Big Ups said. Katie insisted. "You have to. I made them specifically for you guys." Floats was the first to take one. He thanked Katie and took a bite. Crumbs filled his mustache and his eyes rolled. "Oh my God, this could be my favorite thing I've ever put in my mouth." Katie said, "Have as many as you like, but save room. There's pizza for at the top." Big Ups reached for a scone and said, "It's impossible to eat too much." He took a bite, smiled, and added, "You're an angel." "You didn't tell me Big Ups was hot," Katie said. "I hadn't noticed." I motioned for her to pass. With her smaller pack, she was quicker on the uphill. "You guys are all so skinny," she went on. "I should have made two pizzas." "I'm just glad you brought food. I mean, I'm just glad to see you." As we walked on our own, she asked me to describe the highlights of my first week on the AT. I told her about the mini celebration we'd had when we crossed the North Carolina border. There wasn't much to it. We high-fived and posed for some pictures beside the sign. "That climb coming up out of Georgia? I totally get why they call this the Highlands. We came up about 2,000 feet over a couple of miles and haven't gone back down since. Let's see, that was yesterday. Oh, and 2 days ago we had hail. Neat." Katie had grown up in a household fascinated by weather. Her dad has an array of weather stations on the roof, and her sister, Priscilla, grew up to become a meteorologist. "I saw storms on radar, but it looked like rain." "It came out of nowhere, too," I said. "It was nice and sunny, just like this, and then 10 minutes later, gray and cloudy. I was up high when the thunder started, and I heard little pellets hitting my hat. I thought someone was throwing sand at me. Next thing I know, there's little piles of ice all over the place. It was crazy. 15 minutes later, the sun was out, and an hour later, it was melted. So that was pretty cool." I told her about my first resupply trip I'd made into Helen, a small town in northern Georgia that looks like how Walt Disney would imagine Germany. It's supposed to be Bavaria, the locals will tell you. All of the buildings are timbered Tudor style, and there are towers and turrets everywhere, and every street has Dorf in its name. Also, everything was closed. No one in the town had ever heard of a jet boil or whatever kind of weird space-age fuel it took. They did make a mean strudel, though. "Any bears yet?" she asked excitedly. "Not since Shining Rock," I said. "I've heard owls almost every night. I saw one up close the other day. He was in a tree by the trail, just sitting there being all majestic and shit. He even let me take a picture. I'll show you when we get to the top. Did you bring a memory card?" In a zipper pouch on my pack's hip strap, I kept a small waterproof camera. Once I filled its memory card, I would mail it home and insert a spare empty card from my pack. The next package from home would include a new empty spare. That day, we executed the first move in the three-card shuffle by hand rather than by mail. A small wooden sign announced the summit of Standing Indian. We took pictures, found a flat rock with a view, and shared cold pizza. The steady breeze sometimes gusted, bringing with each gust a chill. We scooted together. "Here, look at these pictures," I said, turning on the camera. "Here's me and Mark. There's you." I pushed the right arrow. "Here's a pretty view. Another tree. Here's a rock. Oh, look, here's a mama spider carrying thousands of babies on her back. Ew!" She looked away. When she looked back, the spiders were still there. "Good Lord, that's too many baby spiders." "Aha, check this out," I said, and handed her the camera. You might have to zoom in to read. It was a picture of Lemmy's first cartoon. Katie squinted at the screen, and after a minute she giggled. He must be carrying a whole box of colored pencils. I showed her the second installment. Blood and guts, fur and fangs, big round fuzzy butt splattered with hiker gore. I may have missed one, I skipped a shelter or two. This was where she would turn around and I would keep going. Our plan was to meet again at Klingman's Dome a week later, on Memorial Day weekend, when my mom and my niece Emily would be in Asheville visiting Katie only a 2-hour drive away. At 6,643 feet, Klingman's Dome is the highest point on the Appalachian Trail, and the observation deck on its peak commands a 360-degree view of the Blue Ridge and Smoky Mountains. But it was another 100 miles past the 100-mile mark, which I hadn't reached yet. "What happened to your feather?" Katie asked. When she dropped Mark and me off at Springer Mountain, my hat was sporting a hawk-tail feather I'd picked up during my shakedown hike back at Shining Rock. Now a long black feather was poked in the side of my hat. "A mouse ate it," I said. "Oh, Gary," she said, then corrected herself. "Green giant." I left it outside my tent one night, and when I woke up it was chewed to a nub. Maybe the mouse needed it for his nest. Anyway, I found this one the same day. I think it might be a raven. "Looks like a vulture to me," she said. "Whatever, it still looks cool." "It does," she said. "I like it."
Chapter 4. She Who Shall Not Be Named. I knew I was dreaming, but I couldn't control my actions. I was only able to observe, detached, as hot emotion boiled up from inside, a mix of frustration and anger. I was running through an office building and screaming, but no words would come out, only guttural noises. People talking on phones squirmed in their seats, while others kept typing. My brain and my mouth weren't cooperating, and my overwhelming drive to inspire them just came out as, "Yarg!" "My stick," I thought. "That'll work." I started swinging, knocking phones away from startled faces, smashing monitors and screaming. Why aren't they revolting, I wondered. Can't they see? I tried to shout, "Get up!" But it came out, "Get up!" I needed them to bolt out of their chairs, flip their desks, and run with me. Instead, they just stared, or worse, ignored me. Frustration now bubbling over into rage, I swung my stick harder, scattering paper clips and binders, sending stupid plants grown under humming fluorescent lights toppling to the floor. My shoes crunched dirt and debris into the gray carpet as I rampaged through the cubicles. "Come on! Get up!" I raised my smashing stick once again and it became a trekking pole, and suddenly one of the workers spoke to me. "I don't think you're using that correctly," he said. Dropping the pole and letting my arm fall to my side, I took a deep breath and closed my eyes, then opened them to blackness. I was in my tent. The sleeping bag was twisted and I couldn't find the zipper. The cloth buff I used as a nightcap had worked its way down over my eyes, and the stuff sack of extra clothes I used as a pillow was no longer under my head. It was raining. Pulling the buff from my eyes, I could see the sun was up. The rain was gentle and the sound on my tent calming. I lay still and held on to the dream as it faded. It felt good to run and smash, to incite a riot. I don't get to do that for real. My tent has a very helpful feature that allows me to pack up in the rain without getting soaked. The inner sanctum is made mostly of mesh and hangs from the aluminum poles that support the rainfly. With a bit of contortion, it is possible to separate the two and load everything into my pack without leaving the protection of the fly. The ground was damp, and my head and shoulders kept bumping into the fly, but it worked. I opened the final zipper and emerged like a larva that has eaten its way out of its cocoon. Pulling all the stakes but two, I used them to secure one end of the fly, then picked up the other and shook vigorously. Water sprayed everywhere, and a wet guy line slapped my cheek. While not dry, the fly was now lighter by maybe an extra pound of water. I crammed it into a plastic grocery bag I'd picked up in Helen for just this purpose, then stuffed that into an outside pouch. Pretty slick, I congratulated myself. If it was still raining at the end of the day, I could do my packing routine in reverse order. Meanwhile, all my dry stuff was still dry, and the only wet stuff were things meant to get wet. Then I felt a pang of hunger and remembered my food was still in the bag slung over a high branch. Leaning my pack against the tree, I untied the rope holding the bag. Suddenly, it slipped loose, and I instinctively grabbed it to stop my food from falling. That jerked the branch, sending gallons of rainwater splashing down on my upturned face. Fine, I thought, as the chilly drops found their way under my shirt and between my shoulder blades. I haven't showered in a while anyway. The rain stopped shortly after breakfast, but my glasses kept fogging, so I stowed them in a hard case with my sunglasses, which I had yet to put on. Holding the case for a second and bouncing it like a scale, I figured it weighed a couple ounces. What, maybe four? Same weight as a Clif Bar or a couple packs of ramen. I really didn't need either pair of glasses or the case. How many other little things like that could I find in my pack? Four similar discoveries would relieve me of a pound. That didn't seem like much when I was preparing, but this was my ninth consecutive day of carrying that extra pound. Every backpacking trip I'd ever been on was mainly about getting to a destination and spending time there, but now the point was the walking itself. There was no there for another 2,000 miles. Good Lord, I thought, I really am just getting started. I made a mental note to give myself another shakedown in the next 3 days before Klingman's Dome, so I could hand unnecessary things off to Katie there. Otherwise, I would have to mail it. I put the case into the top zipper pouch of my pack and walked over to a natural window, a small opening in the trees which offered a view. Scanning the mountains on the horizon, I wondered which one I'd come from. One had a fire tower, I remembered. Without binoculars, I squinted at each distant peak until I found one with a tiny raised bump at the tip. "That one right there," I said aloud. "The one that looks like a nipple." My good camera was in my pack, so I took a few pictures with my phone. I tried to call Katie, but there was no signal. We take phones for granted. Back home, if you think of something or see something that you want to share, you just do it. One person or 100, you can let them know almost instantly what you think, feel, or want. If you don't get a signal, you just wait a few minutes, at worst a couple hours. But now I might not be able to send this picture until tomorrow or next week. By no means a crisis, but it was the most disconnected I'd felt since starting, and I liked it. It was more like independence than loneliness. I made a note to remember how it felt not to get that instant gratification. It's amazing that a tiny metal box can give us the power to show distant loved ones an instant photo from where we are. The generation before mine would have expected flying cars before these Star Trek communicators, yet here we are, yawning at pictures of cats while standing in line at the bank. A barely visible half moon was dropping in the west, white against the powder blue sky. The moon lately had started capturing my attention. I rose and set with the sun, but twice the moon had tricked me awake hours before dawn. A waning gibbous moonrise will illuminate your tent as much as your bedside lamp. Sometimes even the birds are fooled. The birds and I usually figured it out pretty quickly and went back to sleep in no time. My rhythms were definitely changing. By the middle of the day, I'd walked 5 miles and climbed 3 or 4 small mountains, and other than being a little sweaty, I felt great. This was usually nap time, but I felt well-rested and ready for more. Maybe it was my imagination, but I also thought I'd been pulling my belt a little tighter each morning when I put on my pants. I patted my belly and decided to stay a bit longer, maybe have a Snickers. The surrounding mountains were beginning to take on a vaguely familiar shape. Before I got to Klingman's Dome, I'd go through the Nantahala National Forest, down into Nantahala Gorge, past one of the most popular centers for whitewater activity in the southeast. Katie, Mark, and I, along with thousands of other kayakers and rafters, had been down the Nanty River dozens of times. We had also hiked along the AT there, occasionally hauling a cooler of beer and some steaks up to Wesserbald Fire Tower. Hiking into familiar territory would be weird, seeing places I recognized. As I lifted my pack, I realized that I could mail things home from the Whitewater Center, but I didn't feel like dumping and sorting my pack before then. Ultimately, it didn't matter. I didn't have to decide any time soon. There weren't any deadlines, and if there were, it was me setting them. So if I didn't like them, I could change them. Everything was entirely up to me. This concept had usually been accompanied by a dose of anxiety, but now it triggered a giddy sense of eagerness. I wondered if I'd see something I knew from the next peak. It was nearing the end of a warm and humid day, and I was a little worn out from the climb as I approached Cold Spring Shelter. It sits a few feet off the trail at a spot where a small stream, no more than a trickle, really, runs across the path. I could hear someone moving around inside, a surprise because I hadn't seen anyone all day. My assumption had been that I'd be camping by myself again that night. When I turned the corner, I saw a young woman with dark braids, sitting on the boards with her feet dangling, a turquoise pack by her side. She and the pack were surrounded by a ring of stuff sacks, garbage bags, piles of clothes, and assorted food containers, some empty but most full. She was rummaging through one of the stuff sacks, either packing or unpacking, when my arrival broke her focus, and she snapped her head in my direction, dropping the sack in her lap. "Sorry," I offered. "I didn't mean to sneak up on you." I still hadn't shared a shelter with anyone, and I wasn't quite ready to begin by spending the night with a young lady who appeared to be hiking solo. My first concern was to avoid making her uncomfortable, but we also hadn't really talked yet, and there was no guarantee that I'd enjoy her company either. The guidebook had mentioned tent sites, a tenth of a mile up the trail, and I was considering that option when we heard a shriek. "Ugh," she muttered, wrinkling her nose. "Do I hear children?" As she threw her arms up in dismay, she knocked over her cooking pot, which rolled off the boards and into the shadows below. "Maybe we'll get along after all," I thought. "Maybe we're lucky and that's the sound of one being eaten by a bear," I said. She didn't respond, and instead began hunting for her pot under the shelter. "If something drags me under there, I'm going to be so pissed. Will you hold this so I can see?" She handed me her headlamp. The top half of her vanished under the boards. I shined her headlamp into the dark below the shelter and leaned my poles against the boards so I would have a free hand to wave off the swarm gathering around my face. From up the trail came more shrieking, punctuated by angry adult barking. After a minute she yelled, "Got it!" and wiggled out backwards, then leapt to her feet and held her cooking pot up like a trophy. I congratulated her, then nodded at the mess and asked, "Are you packing or unpacking?" She shrugged so hard that her hands flew above her shoulders. "I don't know. I haven't decided. There are mosquitoes breeding in the spring right in front of the fucking shelter, but I don't really want to set up my tent next to whatever the hell's going on up there," she said, nodding towards the tent area up the trail in the direction of the shrieking. "Maybe a fire will keep the bugs away. Do you know how to make a fire? I mean, I do, but I'm much better at keeping one going, right? I mean, I'm good at gathering wood and putting it on the fire, but whoever stayed here last didn't leave a shit to work with." She waved her arms like someone trying to point in all directions at once. "Oh, I'm Megan, by the way. Weren't you at the fire tower yesterday? What's your name?" "I'm Gary, or Green Giant if you're into the whole trail name thing. Are you through hiking?" I barely got the words out before she shouted, "You're goddamn right I am!" She began jumping in place. "Ah, cool," I said. "What's your trail name?" "Well," she turned her back to me and resumed moving things from one stuff sack to another. "I wanted to be called Megaly Pegaly, but my first trail family told me that that was too long and I'm not allowed to make up my own trail name and it can't be based on my real name, so that didn't stick. Snail Trail told me I should be called Fire Ass because I like to warm my butt by the fire, but I was like, no, you are not going to call me Fire Ass for the next 6 months. Oh, no, no, no. Do you know Snail Trail?" I confessed that I did not. "But then I was like, you should call me Ninja because I always sneak up on people and no one ever hears me coming. I mean, I don't do it on purpose or to be creepy or anything like that. I'm just a quiet hiker. But anyway, Ninja Mike was like, no, we already have a ninja and I don't want people to think we're a thing. So I was like, whatever, I guess I'm not Ninja. Have you met Ninja Mike?" I confessed that I had not. "So I guess I don't really have one yet, but I'm taking suggestions. Do you have any?" She swatted at the mosquitoes and moved her gear around some more, making it unclear whether she was actually waiting for my reply. "I'll have to think about that," I said, silently considering variations on motor mouth. "Your trail name is supposed to just happen naturally, I guess. Don't worry, you'll get one." She grunted acknowledgement and gobbled a handful of something. As this was perhaps my only chance to utter more than one sentence, I didn't want to waste it. I looked north again and reached for my poles. "Well, the bugs here are pretty atrocious, and it sounds like things might have calmed down up at the tent sites. I might go check those out." "Yeah, I thought about that, too. I might see you up there." She began picking up sticks. "How much wood do you think I need to keep the bugs away?" "All of it." "What time is it?" she asked. "Time for you to take your Ritalin," I thought. 5:30. "Ah, shit," she said, and dropped her bundle of sticks. She moved to the spring and began filtering water. "The next shelter's like 6 more miles. I might just stay here. Have you seen Forager?" I told her that I didn't know who that was, and she returned her attention to the water. "How far are you going today?" she asked. "I just told you," I thought. I pointed up the path where the shrieking had turned to giggling, which was better, but still less than ideal. "Just far enough to get out of earshot of that. Well, hey, good luck with the mosquitoes." I took a few more steps and added, "Bye." "You're not supposed to do that," she said. "Do what?" "Say goodbye," she said. "Never say goodbye to anyone on the trail." "Oh, right," I said. "Good luck with the bugs, and try not to kill any children." "God, no kidding," she said, and I moved on. The tent sites weren't much farther, and when I arrived, I scanned the area. The best site had already been claimed by a young mother who I presumed had been barking at the shrieking toddlers earlier, the same toddlers who now ran in frantic circles around their tiny tents. Their shrieks had resumed, and the barking was sure to follow. Only 6 miles to the next shelter, I thought. If I hauled ass, I would be there at 8:30, right around dark. I could go back to the other shelter with the mosquitoes and the girl. No, I thought, I'll go forward. Plus, something felt wrong about going backwards, even a tenth of a mile. I had plenty of water and was confident that I would find a flat spot before the next shelter. And there was. As I was setting up my tent, I checked my cell phone for a signal. I hadn't heard Katie's voice 4 of the last 5 nights, but tonight I was high up in the Nantahala Forest and was delighted to see one bar. She answered on the second ring. "Holy shit, is it Green Giant?" she exclaimed. Hearing where I was, she told me that some people from our kayaking days would be at the Nantahala Outdoor Center around the same time I would. I should keep my eyes peeled for paddlers. One of them might even spring for a meal. I was on board with this plan. "Too bad you won't be there," I said. "Looks like you're still on track for Klingman's Dome next weekend. I'll see you there, with your mom and Emily. What should we bring? What kind of food do you miss the most?" "This is going to sound weird, but hard vegetables, like cauliflower or carrots." I guess your body lets you know what it's missing. When's the last time you had vegetables?" I thought about it. I'd only just been through Franklin, right? No, that was 3 days ago. I think I had a salad with dinner. I can't remember. It all disappeared so fast. "I guess you're right," I said. "It's been a while, and it wasn't much at that. But I also want those scones again. And cheeseburgers. Let's not do this now. I'm getting dizzy." "I'll surprise you," she said. "So check this out. I just ran into someone rather interesting," I continued. "Was it Lemmy?" "No, not yet. And I haven't seen a cartoon in a while, either. No, I just met someone who I think needs a trail name." I told her about Megan and how she dodged the first half-dozen or so monikers the other hikers had thrown at her. "I think we should call her Nope," I said. "Not bad," Katie said, "but I was thinking Voldemort." "How so? She who shall not be named?" "Damn, Voldemort is much better than Nope. Okay, I'll tell her she's been named." "Just like that, huh?" "Yeah, I think that's all there is to it. And I'm not going to ask her either. She doesn't get the option to consider this one. She needs to focus on other things." I described the piles of garbage bags and stuff sacks. "I seriously couldn't tell if she was coming or going, and she may or may not walk up here to these tent sites. She doesn't even know what her name is." "Gary," Katie said.
"Yes."
"Focus on your own problems."
"I am," I said. "It's just that I have a feeling she's about to become one of them."
Chapter 5. Land of the Noonday Sun. It was morning, and I was in mid-squat when I heard familiar yelling. Shrieking and barking, actually. The lady with her kids, and none of them sounded happy. I'd walked nearly half a mile past their camp the previous night, and had been up since sunrise, but they must have had an early start. They were approaching faster than I'd expected, and now these kids were about to see a full moon rising. I was too close to the trail. The first kid crested the hill just as I duck-walked behind a bush, hunkered down even lower, and hushed my breathing. I'm in it now, I thought. I'm committed, like a sniper. I can't exactly pop up from behind this bush with my pants around my ankles and introduce myself. Pepper spray really hurts. His sister followed. "Stop bouncing," their mother yelled from behind. She repeated herself, this time loud enough to crack her voice. "Stop bouncing! It's inefficient!" She turned to a child behind her, barely a toddler. I couldn't tell if the miniature curly mop concealed a little boy's or girl's face. The child scurried to catch up as his or her mom scolded, "Get up here with your brother and sister. Move!" She pounded her trekking pole into the ground, punctuating each command with a puff of dirt. "And stop bouncing!" I felt an urge to yell back at her, but it's hard to be intimidating when you're naked from the waist down. I waited for them to pass. They slowed down as the boy noticed my tent and pointed, but his mom yelled, and the group marched on. Once they were out of earshot, I finished up and returned to my tent site, where rays of sunlight had just begun to touch my makeshift clothesline. My shirts were made of a quick-drying material, but the humid night air had the opposite effect, and I had to wring them out. Reluctantly, I moved my dry sleeping shirt and chose the lesser of two wet tees. When my head popped through the hole, Voldemort was there. "Boo!" "Good thing you didn't get here just a few minutes ago," I said, waving my shovel at her. "And you're right, you really do sneak up on people." She leaned on her poles. "Yeah, I really want my trail name to be Ninja. Stupid Michael." "Ninja Mike? The one you mentioned yesterday?" "Yeah," she sighed. "He's dreamy. He dresses like a gorgeous pirate. And I think he's a judo instructor or something. Anyway, he said I couldn't be Ninja."
My pack was ready and I hoisted it, motioning for her to lead.
Well, it doesn't matter, because I have your trail name, I said. I was talking to my wife last night.
Oh, where is she?
She stopped and looked back at the campsite.
On the phone, I said.
I was telling her about you and how...
Did you actually get a signal up here? She asked.
Yes.
Who's your carrier?
I said,
AT&T. Anyway, do you know what that stands for?
I think I do, but why don't you just go ahead and...
It stands for Appalachian Trail Terrible.
Ha!
I wanted to be annoyed by her, but she was right. My coverage had sucked.
That's pretty good, I said. Do you want to know what your trail name is?
Oh, yeah.
She quickened her pace.
So anyway, I was telling Katie about how you kept rejecting trail names, and she said,
she who shall not be named.
Voldemort.
Huh?
What do you think?
What's a Voldemort?
I stopped.
You're kidding, right?
No, what's a Voldemort?
How old are you?
22.
No, 23.
And you've never read or seen Harry Potter?
I know what Harry Potter is, she said.
I grew up sheltered from pop culture. No TV in the house. No movies, you know.
I didn't know.
I had been in line to see Star Wars the day it came out. When I was 7, I had Mork and Mindy, That's Incredible, and eventually Hall and Oates. Pop culture was the metronome for my childhood, but when she explained that she grew up in northern Maine with hundreds of acres of land and horses, I had to concede that she didn't really miss much. We had plenty of time and nothing else to do but walk, so I explained to her the concept of the boy who lived and the evil wizard.
So Voldemort's a dude, huh?
You okay with that? I asked.
I like it even more now, she said.
Now when I sign the logbooks, it will confuse my enemies. My trail name was almost Hiking Home, she said.
Because you're from Maine?
I'm kind of hiking home too, I said.
For a while, at least.
Once we get past Hot Springs, I'll be hiking away. Starting my hike so close to home made me feel a little guilty. Several hikers I met confessed that they were homesick. Meanwhile, I'd already seen my wife twice, plus my friend was likely to be waiting to see me at the outdoor center, and I'd see people I knew at Hot Springs and again at Damascus. I tried not to bring it up often, so as not to make anyone jealous.
"Doesn't bother me a bit," Voldemort said.
"When we get up north, the roles will be reversed. Besides, I'm used to being on my own." The time flew by. Having company was refreshing, and talking to Voldemort was far better than talking to myself. Different people's unique hiking paces tend to isolate us on the trail. When I asked her if I was walking too slow or too fast, she said, "I can hike at any pace. So how well do you know this section of the trail?"
"Tellico Gap will be where I first start to see places I recognize," I said.
"That's where we used to park and hike up to the Weser Fire Tower. Then we'll go down the gorge and into the Nantahala Outdoor Center. I've been there more times than I can remember. Once we cross the train tracks just past NOC, we'll be back into unfamiliar territory. So not much, really, just a few miles." I had to stop along the way for a call of nature, which turned into a snack by a stream, so Voldemort went on without me for a while. When I arrived at Tellico Gap, a homeless man was there pretending to be a thru-hiker. He had cornered a couple day hikers who were trying to enjoy the view, and after accepting a candy bar, he asked if they had any beer. I had seen him before at a previous shelter where he had tried the same trick on me. After talking to him for 30 seconds, it was clear he had no idea where Springer Mountain was and no idea where the trail even went. The southern portion of the trail attracts a small number of mostly harmless transients in the springtime, and this one wanted me to vouch for him.
"Hey, I know you," he yelled, pointing at me. "I know this guy. He's all right."
"Not gonna happen, buddy." I waved politely and rushed the next half mile up to the tower, skipping the break I had planned and foregoing any pictures from the gap. After 15 minutes of huffing and puffing, I reached the tower. From its base, I could hear Voldemort talking on the platform above, presumably to the owners of the two new packs resting at the bottom. I ditched mine, selected a water bottle, and started climbing the rusty metal stairs. Well, I did try to start my own YouTube channel for a while, but it was all just videos of me talking, and everyone was like, "What are you even talking about?" And I was like, "Whatever, this is just me." So, yeah, I talk a lot, but only when I really need to be entertained and no one else will do it, right? Hey, who's that coming up the stairs? Green Giant, is that you? At just over 100 feet, the Weser Bald Fire Tower sways in the slightest of breezes, and the winding stairs are almost steep enough to qualify as a ladder. As I cleared the last one, I could see Voldemort lying spread-eagle in the center of the platform with a towel over her face. She had stripped to her shorts and a sports bra, and her legs and belly were turning pink as the sun glared from a cloudless sky. She lifted a corner of the towel to greet me, then dropped it again.
Her audience identified themselves as Blue Indian and Droid. Blue Indian was a recent college graduate, lean and tall, with short-cropped blonde hair. He was about to start his new job handling falcons and other birds of prey at a large zoo in the south, and was near the end of a week-long vacation on the trail. Droid was still in college. He was seeing how far he could hike before classes started back up in the fall. Voldemort continued to talk about nothing from under her towel while the three of us took in the view. The fire tower on Wesserbald commands one of the most spectacular views along the southern Appalachian Trail. In all directions you are surrounded by monstrous green wrinkles stretching to the horizon. That puddle in the distance is the lake at Fontana Dam, which marks the beginning of the Smokies. It feels like you can see the curvature of the earth from up there. I interrupted whatever Voldemort was saying and told them about the time I spent a night atop the tower. We came up here after a day on the river. My wife smartly set up her tent down there, I said, pointing to a flat spot near the base of the tower. My buddy Pimp and I got way too drunk and decided it was a good idea to just roll out our sleeping bags right here on top of the tower. Yeah? Blue Indian squinted behind his dark sunglasses. How'd that work out for you? It was a damn near perfect night, I said, until about 5:30 in the morning when the rain started. It was just a light drizzle, but we hauled ass down the stairs anyway. Pimp had a one-man tent, and I strung a tarp between these supports, I pointed below. The tarp kept me dry until it turned into a full-blown thunderstorm. Rain came in sideways. I was soaked, and then the lightning started and we're under a giant metal thing, the highest point for miles. No fucking way did we stick around. We all packed our shit and hauled ass back down to the gap. I pointed at the trail where we had made our retreat from the lightning, the same way I had come up today. Voldemort lifted her towel again and propped herself up on her elbows. Her eyes followed my finger. The service road? Why'd you come up that way? I always come up that way. That's not the AT, man, Droid said. That is. He pointed to an opening in the tree near the base of the tower. It was a trail I'd seen 100 times and had never taken. They both come up from the gap. You just took the easy route. Voldemort gave me a sympathetic look. If you want, we'll wait here while you go back and get it. Get what? I asked. The part you missed, she said. You're kidding, right? Why would I walk to the bottom of this mountain that I just climbed, turn around and climb it again? A descent which, by the way, I've done honestly probably 6 times, for what, 0.5 mile, maybe 0.8 of white blazes? If it was me, I'd do it, Voldemort said. Well, I've carefully weighed the pros and cons, and I've decided against it. It would be inefficient, I said. We stared at the horizon while Voldemort baked in the sun. Hey, did you guys see that lady and her kids? I asked. Each of them had. When Blue Indian saw the children, they were full of energy and practically running up the hills. Meanwhile, Droid reported a death march. Those kids are probably already at the bottom, said Voldemort, looking at the gorge. And this thing looks like a real knee-breaker. Good thing they only weigh 40 pounds, I said. She was right, it was an ass-kicker. We stood up to get started, and suddenly I noticed Voldemort's legs. Dude, you are as red as a lobster. How long have you been up here? She told me that she'd been on her back for at least an hour before I showed up. She assured me that she would be okay. She was a lifeguard every summer in college, and that she was used to being in the sun all the time, and that even though she hated kids, she loved being a lifeguard because it meant that sometimes she got to yell at kids, and that if she used her lifeguard money to fund her hike, and I told her to stop talking and get in the shade. Down we went, and under the cover of trees, we made our plan. The bottom of Nantahala Gorge is the lowest elevation on the trail up to that point, 137 miles north of Springer Mountain. Following the white blazes will take you down nearly 4,000 feet over 7 miles. If it were flat, we could easily make the Nantahala Outdoor Center by nightfall, but then we would have to pay to stay there. The A. Rufus Morgan shelter was barely a mile from the bottom, and it was free. We could stay there, then resupply at the NOC in the morning and hang out by the falls watching the kayakers until my friends showed up. After eating something, we would climb back up out of the gorge that afternoon. The only thing about that shelter is that sometimes it can be kind of a party place, I said. It's a quick walk up from the NOC, and a lot of river rats like to haul booze up there and get rowdy. Fine by me, Voldemort said. I'll drink their beer. We started our hike down. By 2 p.m., the sun was already behind the mountain. Nantahala is the Indian word meaning land of the noonday sun. When you're all the way down in the notch, you only get a couple hours of direct sunlight. The water's freezing, too. The hike down into Nantahala Gorge was the first time my legs were worked to the point of being wobbly. This was more work than running, constantly having to slow myself, breaking not only my own weight but also my pack, fighting gravity all the way down the steepest decline of the hike so far. For the first few minutes after each stop, my thighs would shiver unless I stretched. My pack prevented the foot grab, which is essential to a good quad stretch, but I didn't feel like taking it off, so I just kept walking. Every half hour, Voldemort would zoom past me. I would find her a half mile or so later, standing on a rock or looking at a bug. I joined her at a break in the trees called the Jump Off, that offered a view to a similar lookout called the Jump Up on the opposite side of the gorge. We gave up looking for it without binoculars. The gap was about 2 miles wide as the crow flies, but we would have to walk about 10 to traverse the sea of green beneath us. "What's the name of this place we're stopping at tonight?" she asked. "I don't have the guide for the next few days." "What happened to your guide?" I asked. "I needed kindling a few nights ago and accidentally ripped out the pages for where I was going instead of where I'd been." She seemed embarrassed. "Don't feel bad. I accidentally stayed in Helen instead of Hiawassee because they were on the same page. Shit like that's gonna happen. Anyway, it's called the A. Rufus Morgan Shelter. I have no idea who A. Rufus Morgan was. I've stayed there like 2 or 3 times, maybe. We used to night hike to the shelter after a day on the river, and then go up to the tower the following day." "Droid and Blue Indian are probably already there," she said. Most of our descent was in the green tunnel. At a few places, mainly at switchbacks, we had views below. We could hear the river faintly, but the gorge was too steep for us to see it. Our ears popped, and the moist air grew cooler as we continued down. When we entered the clearing at the shelter, it felt like bedtime. The shadow of the gorge filtered the late afternoon glow into a pale dusk. Droid and Blue Indian had already set up their tents downhill and far from the shelter. "Don't go anywhere near that thing," Droid yelled from their camp. "It's haunted." Voldemort immediately started toward the shelter, her head thrust forward and her pace quickening, eager to see what he meant. I followed her. "Oh yeah, I forgot to mention, we never stay in the shelter." Voldemort stopped short and wrinkled her nose. There was no shelter log, nor was there a broom. The empty remains of a case of Pabst Blue Ribbon were piled in one corner. A filthy, crumpled tarp filled the other. A lone millipede vanished between the floorboards. "Look how small this thing is," she said. "You'd have to lay sideways, Green Giant." "Even Droid wouldn't fit in this thing," I said. "I heard that." Droid and Blue Indian had walked up the small hill to greet us. More garbage stuffed down into the footwell, and a cloud of horrible insects with legs longer than their wings, like dragonflies without bodies, further tarnished the legacy of A. Rufus Morgan. "I don't remember this place ever being so trashed," I said, feeling a little ashamed. "When my friends and I came here, we never left any garbage behind. Not all boaters are like this." Voldemort growled. "What I don't get is this. Your garbage there is now lighter than it was when you carried it in. Why not just fucking take it out, too?" We all agreed that it was too much for even the four of us to haul. We each had our own trash in our packs already, as we should. We moved down the hill and away from the shelter. A small stream ran at the edge of the clearing, where a few long logs lay circling an ash-filled fire pit. The ground was sloped everywhere, and Blue Indian and Droid had already set up their tents in the last 2 spots that were remotely flat. There was very little grass, and the place was picked clean of firewood. The four of us laughed and joked as much as we could during dinner, but the deep shadows combined with our sore legs to drive everyone into their tents early. I didn't sleep well on the sloping ground and kept waking up crumpled at the foot of my tent. I would scuttle back up and try to lie perfectly still, but the slightest movement sent me sliding down again. Eventually, the exhaustion from the day's steep descent took over and I blacked out. Soon the birds were singing and we were up again. I felt hungrier than I had been in years, maybe since boot camp. Voldemort had had a rough night too, sliding down in her sleeping bag and itching from her sunburn. Droid and Blue Indian had enjoyed a more peaceful rest. When I called dibs on a flat space at our next stop, they told me to hike faster. The birds continued to sing as we broke camp. As we were only a mile from the river at the bottom of the gorge, the mist touched everything. I stowed my dripping rainfly, and Droid put on the damp shirt he had hung to dry the night before. We were near the lowest point on the trail so far, and our experience here at that shelter was fitting. The day brightened as we left the shelter. It was going to be hot. Mountain laurels were blooming, their flowers like little white teacups just bigger than a thimble. The trail crossed a few little streams and footbridges, and soon the distant shush of the river was joined by the sound of tires on dirt, people laughing, and the occasional rumble of motorcycles. The short walk improved all of our moods, mine especially, as I began to recognize our surroundings. It was the first time I had been to the Nantahala Outdoor Center without driving. The trail dumped us onto a parking lot behind the general store, a long wooden building with dozens of kayaks leaning on it. We dropped our packs among the boats and rushed into the bathrooms, excited to wash our hands and faces and throw away our trash. It was a curious thing to be excited to see a trash can. Across the busy road was a sprawling compound of buildings, with parking lots choked with people and buses rigged to carry rafts. A crowd was forming at one of the outbuildings where paddles, helmets, and life vests were being distributed. Children and adults in wetsuits jostled and shoved to cross a metal footbridge spanning the river. "Where's your friend supposed to meet us, Green Giant?" asked Voldemort. "I have no idea," I said. "I haven't had a signal for 2 days, so I don't know if anyone's even coming. I guess we'll see, huh?" We tried to stick together, but failed. While I was in the outfitters perusing their meager selection of dehydrated meals, the others scattered. Voldemort wanted a shower, Droid returned to the general store, and Blue Indian, who only had 2 more days on the trail, went to a restaurant to check out their beer list. For the next hour, we moved from one building to another, sometimes running into each other until we finally arrived at the restaurant, which had a deck overlooking the water. 4 seats and a beer list, please," said Blue Indian. The rest of us took a pass on beers, concerned how a belly full of bubbles would feel on the climb back out of the gorge in the heat. We were waiting for our plates and examining our maps when I heard a familiar voice call my name from the other side of the room. It was my friend, Joe Bill. I jumped up to hug him, but stopped short. "Dude, I smell. You don't want to..." "I don't care, man. Good to see you." He lived about 45 minutes away, about halfway to my house. We had met years before on a kayaking trip and had paddled the Nantahala River together many times. I introduced my friends at the table. "Joe Bill's a veterinarian," I told them. Blue Indian, happy to meet a kindred spirit working with animals, stood and offered a hand. Droid is studying engineering, and Voldemort, or Megan, just graduated with, what was it again? "Neuroscience and anthropology," she said. "I see you've fallen in with the nerds," Joe Bill said. He joined us at the table and pelted us with questions. "What's your typical day like?" "It's been almost 2 weeks, and I still don't know how to answer that yet," I said. "We pretty much walk all day, but that's the only thing the days have in common." "Seen any bears yet?" None of us had, but we were all happy to discuss the birds, bugs, and salamanders that were everywhere. I asked Joe Bill if he'd talk to Katie and to tell her I loved her and missed her. Then our plates arrived, and for a short time the only sound was forks and knives on glass. Voldemort straightened up in her seat and pointed her fork at each of us. She chewed faster, twirled her fingers in a just-a-minute gesture, and swallowed half of her enormous bite. "So here's something interesting," she said, reloading her fork. "Remember that lady with the kids?" she asked. "I ran into a chick at the store who saw them, too. She said the kids looked miserable. She talked to her and said they're doing the whole trail." "Wow, that sounds..." Joe Bill trailed off. "Crazy," I said. "I was going to say impressive, actually," he said. "No," I said, "crazy. One of those kids is like 4 years old." I turned to Voldemort. "Did she say where they are now?" "I think they're taking a zero here," she said, and explained the term to Joe Bill. "0 miles? A day off?" Blue Indian added, "I saw them. They looked pretty tired. Someone else told me that one of the kids said they weren't allowed to play near any streams or they'd get yelled at. I wonder what their deal is." We 4 hikers had cleaned our plates when Joe Bill pushed his away. Voldemort and I both asked, "Are you going to finish that?" He shook his head and we split what was left in less than a minute. "So how about that beer?" Blue Indian asked. "None for me," Voldemort said. "I'm on a budget." "Not today, you're not," Joe Bill said. "I got this." We protested, but he insisted. "Gary, you just quit your job, and you 3 just graduated. Besides, I'm really impressed by what you guys are doing. I really wish I could do something like this. The least I can do is get your lunches." "Lunches?" I asked. "This was supposed to be second breakfast. What time is it?" "It's almost noon." "Ah, shit. Guys, we gotta get moving. We still have like 8 more miles today, and it's literally all uphill." Blue Indian smiled. "So just the 1 beer, then?" "Fine, just 1. I hugged Joe Bill at his car and told him again to give my love to Katie. "One last thing," he said, opening the passenger door. He picked up a bag and handed it to me. "There should be enough Snickers bars in there for all you guys. Some beef jerky, too. I asked Katie what you like to eat, and she gave me a list. That's all I could find on my way in, though." The bars were starting to melt in their wrappers, but I didn't care. I thanked him and hugged him again, then hurried to catch my friends, who had gotten a head start on the big climb out of the gorge. As I walked among the boaters, it hit me that I had never taken the trail north from here. I had no idea where to go. I wandered a few minutes before asking a raft guide where the trail was. Before I even finished my question, he pointed me to the train tracks behind the far parking lot. Neither the sign nor the white blaze were easy to spot among the thick bushes behind the tracks, but eventually I found both, and soon my climb began. Out of habit, I checked my phone for a signal. I expected none and got exactly what I expected. I squinted up at the sun directly overhead and could already feel my ears and cheeks turning red. This place is living up to its name for sure, I thought, unrolling the brim of my hat for more cover. My next supply stop would be at Klingman's Dome, some 70 trail miles away. This was going to be the longest I'd ever go without a resupply stop until maybe the 100-mile wilderness in Maine, so my pack was already at its heaviest before Joe Bill handed me 3 pounds of chocolate and meat. The 2 water bottles I brought to combat the heat added 4 more pounds. I could feel the pack shift with every step, like an angry midget trying to wrestle me off the trail. Leaning on my trekking poles for support with every step, I slowly realized what I had to do. I had to lighten my load. I had to eat some of that chocolate. My pack's hip belt was already digging into my stomach, which was full and gurgling from eggs and beer. I happily released the belt and dropped my pack to search for the Snickers bars. In my head, I knew that eating a pound of food I had been carrying in a backpack would not actually lighten my load, merely redistribute it, but I didn't care as I clutched a mushy chocolate bar, tearing away at the wrapper with my teeth. Better eat some jerky, too, I thought. I didn't want to keep climbing in this heat with a taste of salty meat in my mouth, so I put 1 more Snickers in my pocket and pressed on. About 5 miles into the 8-mile climb, I caught up with Voldemort, resting at the jump up, the break in the trees which offered a view to the other side of the gorge. "Good Lord, this climb sucks," I said, and plopped onto the rock where she sat. "No shit," she said. "I just want a fucking nap." "Seriously. Hey, want some chocolate?" I offered her what was left of the bag Joe Bill had given me. "No thanks," she said. "I can barely fit what I already have into my pack." "Really?" I said. "I've never known a woman to turn down free chocolate." "I'm not like the other girls," she assured me. "Plus, I have a package waiting for me at the Fontana Dam." Fontana Dam marks the beginning of the Smokies, and is where Blue Indian would leave the trail the day after next. We'd heard from other hikers that the supply there was hit or miss, which was why I was carrying enough food to get me to Klingman's Dome. We hiked the next 2 miles together, up to the shelter at Sassafras Gap. As soon as the wooden box was visible, she ran the last few yards, yelling, "Puddin'!" Puddin' was a large man wearing a tie-dyed shirt. 2 weeks into the hike, most of the guys were starting to get some stubble. There were even a few real beards. Puddin' had gray whiskers down to the middle of his chest. He stood and smiled at her approach. "Megan!" he called back and wrapped her in a bear hug, lifting both her and her pack easily. "Damn, girl, you're pink. You been sunbathing?" "Ugh, I know. And it's Voldemort now," she said. "Some kind of evil wizard who eats babies or something. Puddin', this is Green Giant." I shook his hand and he greeted me warmly, minus the hug. They had met a while ago, back when I was just getting started. Hell, I was still just getting started. Puddin' was part of her original trail family, along with Ninja Mike and a few others whose names I didn't catch. Sore shins had forced her to spend a couple days in town, and she'd been left behind. Now, as they caught up, I scanned the shelter log for more cartoons, but found none. "Your boyfriend was just here," Puddin' said. "Who?" she asked. "Big Indian. He was with a kid named Robot or something." "Droid? Oh, we're not together." "His loss," Puddin' said, and winked at me. I looked at my guidebook. "They're probably going to Chiyoabald." Puddin' nodded. "That's the place. You should really consider joining them. It's only another mile and has one of the best views you'll get for a long time. 360-degree views and a fire ring." Voldemort encouraged him to join us, but Puddin' declined. "As much as I'd love to, my old bones are tired, and it's a rough mile. Plus, you'll have to carry water, and I'm already settled." He motioned to the inside of the shelter where his sleeping bag was already rolled out. "Maybe we'll run into each other again," she said, hopefully. "Probably not, honey. You and those young fellas really pour it on. I've been here since noon, and I probably won't get going until noon tomorrow." She hugged him again, and after we filtered enough water for dinner and breakfast, we pushed on once again. Chiawabald is a clearing the size of a baseball diamond atop a 5,000-foot peak, which stands 1,000 feet taller than its nearest neighbor. Other than a few trees at the edge of the clearing, there is nothing to block the view. Blue Indian and Droid were setting up their tents when we arrived.
"God damn, what a beautiful spot," I said.
"I know, right?" said Voldemort, carefully removing her pack and wincing as a strap rubbed against her sunburned shoulder. It was late afternoon and we were worn out. We had hiked 15 miles that day, descending from one of the highest points so far, down into the lowest point, and back up to another high. I keep a small thermometer on the outside of my pack. A few hours earlier it had read almost 90 degrees. Up here on the Bald it was much cooler, and I stood for a minute with my eyes closed, enjoying the breeze. After I set up my tent, the four of us sat on logs around a circle of rocks filled with cold coals. "Looks like it might be clear tonight," I said. Every campsite and shelter so far had been inside the green tunnel, and I hadn't seen the night sky in weeks. "If we can manage to stay awake for a while after dark, I'll give you guys a quick astronomy lesson. I mean, if you don't mind, that is. My second favorite hobby besides hiking is astronomy."
"That sounds pretty sweet," Blue Indian said.
"It would be sweeter if we had a telescope or even binoculars, but I have a feeling that just looking up with our eyes is going to be pretty damned amazing." Droid left the circle, grinning, and said, "I have something that will make this even more amazing." He reached into a zipper pouch on his pack and pulled out a small drawstring bag. "We need to make sure we're safe up here." Blue Indian nodded. "Yes, time for a safety meeting." Voldemort looked up from a pile of stuff sacks surrounding her. "What's a safety meeting? Are we in danger?"
"No, no, no, no," I said. "Safety is weed.
I thought only kayakers said that."
Droid said, "I thought only rock climbers called it that."
"I'm down," Voldemort said. Droid packed a small pipe for us, and we passed it around while the sun dropped closer to the horizon.
"Thanks," I said. "Some guys I hiked with at the start gave me a joint I've been carrying around for a few days, too. I almost busted it out last night, but I still wasn't sure. I mean, you never know who's okay with it or not."
"Dude, we're all in our 20s, Blue Indian said. "We're pretty much down for whatever." Droid pointed the pipe at me. "Now you, on the other hand, we weren't sure about you, but I said fuck it."
"What's that supposed to mean?" I asked.
"Well, you're like 50 or something, right?"
"I'm 44, I said. "There's a shit ton of smokers in my age group. We're all just weird about it for some stupid reason. None of us gave a fuck when we were in our 20s either."
"That'll change," he said. "So what's your deal?"
"What do you mean?" I asked.
Blue Indian leaned over and snatched the lighter, and Droid continued.
"I mean, most hikers are either our age or retired. Are you, like, having a midlife crisis or something?"
"I guess it looks that way, huh? No, I just really love to hike and finally got to the point where I could do this. When I was your age..." "Ah, shit, did I just say that? Fuck. Anyway, when I was your age, I didn't even know there was an AT. By the time I knew it was a thing, I had a house and bills and shit. So, a couple of years ago, I made up my mind, saved as much as I could, and here I am."
"So what about your job?" asked Voldemort. "Did you get 6 months off?"
"I quit."
Blue Indian's eyes bugged out.
"Just like that?" "That's really all there is to it. I saved up enough to do this and cover my bills while I'm gone, and here I am."
"What will you do when you get back?"
"I have no idea."
"And your wife?
She must be pretty cool to let you do this."
"No, she doesn't let me do anything. What I mean is, we have an arrangement where neither of us asks permission to do stuff. If she gets a crazy idea that makes her happy, we talk about it and find a way to make it happen. If I want to buy something for me, I don't have to get her jewelry to make up for it. Just stuff like that."
Blue Indian said, "Does she hike too?"
"Oh yeah, she hikes. She's kind of a badass, but she's only good for about 2 weeks at a stretch. Besides, we can't both quit our jobs. She's running the show from back home. Speaking of which..." I passed the pipe and checked my phone. Still no signal.
"Shit. Appalachian Trail terrible, right? Anyone have a signal?"
"I do," Voldemort said.
"Four bars."
"Would I be able to convince you to text Katie for me? Just say hi and that I'm still on track for next weekend. She'll know."
I gave her the number, and while she typed, the rest of us stood and stretched. On the eastern side of the Bald, the sky was beginning to turn the color of a ripe peach. We moved to the west side and stood together, mesmerized by the sunset. The horizon seemed hundreds of miles away, and every inch between us and the edge of the earth was covered green. Deep shadows filled the spaces between countless peaks, lengthening as we watched in silence. "We're going there," I thought. "We're going to walk right to the edge of everything we can see. And when we get there, we'll see a new edge and walk to that. And again. And again. For forever. Standing there on that mountain, watching the sky catch fire, it felt like we had all of eternity before us to do whatever we wanted, to control where we went and what we saw and how we felt. The entire world was ours for the taking. A dim point of light shone in the periwinkle part of the sky. That one's called Arcturus,